Welcome to Ideas and Issues. I'm Hugh LaFollette, Professor of Philosophy at East Tennessee State University. My guest this evening is Duane Gish, Senior Vice President for the Institute for Creation Research, and we're going to be discussing creationism and evolution, and he's going to be explaining why he thinks that creationism is a better view. Glad to have you with us, Dr. Gish.
Thank you very much, Dr. LaFollette. It's my pleasure to be here today.
Thank you. Perhaps it would be helpful for you to tell the listeners a little bit about your background and how you came to be at the Institute.
Yes. Well, I got my doctorate in biochemistry in the University of California at Berkeley. Then I went to Cornell University Medical College in New York City for 3 years and researched there on synthesizing hormones in the pituitary gland. Then I returned to Berkeley, where I served on the staff, research staff of the virus laboratory at UC for 4 years, where we collaborated in working out the chemical structure of the protein of tobacco mosaic virus. Then I went to the Upjohn Company in Kalamazoo, Michigan, a pharmaceutical firm. I was on their research staff for 11 years. During this time, I had become very interested in the subject of origins. I am a creationist. I am convinced my experience, my research as a biochemist was sufficient to convince me that life had to be created. It's just impossible. I say not only a very low probability, I believe impossible for life to have evolved naturally. And I became associated with some other scientists who were creationists, and we formed the Creation Research Society in 1963, beginning with 10 members. We have about 700 members today. And then in 1971, after 11 years with the Upjohn Company, I left that position to join with Dr. Henry Morris in San Diego in this research institute. We call ourselves the Institute for Creation Research. We have 8 scientists full-time on our staff now who have their doctorate in some area of science from major universities. And it has taken me all over the world since that time. And now it's really been 25 years that I've been doing this, you might say, full-time writing, speaking, and so forth.
Okay. Well, you said in your sort of opening account that you think that creationism is vastly superior to evolution. Perhaps you could just outline 3 or 4 of the reasons why, and then let's go back and look at each of those.
Okay, I'll try to do that briefly. First of all, one of my favorite areas is the origin of life as a biochemist. And if we take the utter complexity of even a bacterium, which I believe is so complex, if we studied it forever, there might be some things about it we'd not understand. We see how everything has to be put together precisely for life to function. We see the purposefulness in every detail of a structure and function. And when we look at that complexity and then look at the idea of a few simple molecules swimming around in some hypothetical primitive ocean, the idea that these things would have put themselves together to make that living cell, it goes against chemical kinetics, everything we know in chemistry and physics. It had to be created. I would join with Sir Fred Hoyle, a famous astronomer in England who was an atheist most of his life. He has concluded that life had to be created. Therefore, he says there must be a God. So the complexity, the utter impossibility, I believe, of life evolving naturally, it had to be created supernaturally. When we look at the universe itself, supposedly, according to evolution, it started with some Big Bang, the chaos and disorder of the Big Bang and the simplicity of hydrogen gas. Supposedly, then it transformed itself without any outside help whatsoever into the incredibly complex universe we have today. That is a clear violation of the second law of thermodynamics. The second law always applies to isolated systems. The universe supposedly is an isolated system. That law says any system such as that, left to itself, will never, ever become more complex, more highly organized, more ordered, but it will always inevitably become less organized, more disordered. It'll deteriorate. And therefore, the idea the universe started in some primordial state of chaos and disorder and transformed itself in the universe we have today is a clear violation of the second law. In other words, the universe had to be created supernaturally. It could not have created itself naturally. And finally, when we look at the fossil record, If evolution is true, of course, the fossil record should be just full of incredible number of transitional forms. Supposedly we started with a microscopic organism, which has evolved into everything living today, millions of species, including people. That would, of course, generate an enormous number of transitional forms, or intermediates. When we look at the fossil record, we see something very different. We see what is called the Cambrian explosion. All of a sudden, in the fossil record, we find billions times billions of fossils of clams and snails, trilobites, worms, sponges, jellyfish, and things like that. And nowhere on the face of this earth has anyone ever found any fossilized ancestors for these complex invertebrates. Furthermore, evolutionists suppose one of these invertebrates evolved into fishes. They think it took maybe 100 million years. We have billions times billions of fossils of the invertebrates. We have billions and billions of fossil fishes. If this is true, we should have an enormous number of transitional forms showing some invertebrate evolving into the fishes. As a matter of fact, we have none. Every major kind of fish that we know anything about appears fully formed. There's not a trace of an ancestor, not a trace of any intermediates between these major kind of fishes. Now, that fossil record of the invertebrates and of the vertebrates to fishes establishes beyond doubt that evolution has not taken place on this planet. Now, the only alternative, of course, is creation. And when we see the design, the purpose, everywhere about us, we always look for a designer. Well, we see that in this universe, and I believe this is just some of the evidence that I'd say demands creation.
Can we go back and maybe talk a little bit more about each of those? The first point, I take it, is that life in particular is extremely complex, and that there is no chance that that life could have emerged merely by chance.
Is that correct? I'm saying. It could not have created itself naturally. If we look at, you see, when we have energy coming from the sun down on the earth, and if you have simple gases starting with that, that ultraviolet light from the sun is terribly, terribly destructive. It could not possibly convert those simple gases into complex molecules. If there were any complex molecules, they'd be rapidly destroyed by the ultraviolet light coming from the sun. And the life requires tremendously complex systems. You've got to have proteins and DNA and RNA and things like that. If you calculate the probability, for example, of amino acids arranging themselves in the precise order required to make a biologically active enzyme or something like that, if you calculate that probability, even if you assume a trillion different arrangements would work, the probability that they arrange themselves in that way is essentially nil. I would say this. In 5 billion years, you couldn't get one molecule of a biologically active protein by chance. The probability of that happening by chance is so slim that it wouldn't happen. Now, you've got to have billions of tons of hundreds of different kinds of proteins. You've got to have billions of tons each of hundreds of different kinds of DNA and RNA molecules to get life started. And they have to be organized into systems, you see. The DNA must be transcribed into messenger RNA. You've got to have the amino acids linking up with transfer RNA, which requires specific enzymes. You've got to have the ribosomes. You've got to have all of that, and all has to be organized to have life. It's just impossible that that would have happened by any chance process whatsoever. That what happens out there, if we just put stuff in water and put it out and let it be irradiated by ultraviolet lights, whatever we've got there is destroyed. It doesn't become organized at all.
Okay. All right. And the second point you mentioned is you said that it violates the second law of thermodynamics. I take it you're sort of comparing one science with the insights of another science. Is that correct, that you're taking the second law as a correct description of the way the universe is, and then saying that that's incompatible with the idea that life could have emerged, could have organized itself in ways that it would have emerged?
Yes, what I'm saying. The second law of thermodynamics is one of the most well-tested laws known in science. Now, the evolutionists will immediately say, well, the second law only applies to isolated or closed systems. The Earth is not a closed system. It's open to the energy from the sun, and that takes care of the problem. Well, may I point out, first of all, the universe itself, in the evolutionary point of view, is an isolated system, so it would apply to the origin universe. The universe could not have created itself. Secondly, just having an open system and energy coming in from the outside is a solution to nothing. Right now, the reason life can exist on the Earth is two reasons. Well, first of all, we have to have that energy coming from the sun, of course. But we have to have a layer of ozone surrounding the Earth to filter out that deadly, destructive ultraviolet light, allowing only visible light to penetrate. Then we must have green plants with a very complex photosynthetic system, plus much else, of course, in order to utilize that visible light. Now, if you have these living organisms, you have green plants, you have the ultraviolet light filtered out by ozone and all that, then life can exist. But you see, in the beginning, on the hypothetical primitive Earth, according to evolutionists, there was no oxygen, therefore there's no ozone, and so that deadly, destructive ultraviolet light would reach right down to the Earth. Even a simple molecule like ammonia cannot exist in its presence. Ammonia is decomposed into nitrogen and hydrogen by ultraviolet light, and the more complex a molecule is, the less stable it is. And the idea then that this raw energy coming in from the outside, acting on simple molecules, is going to convert those things into proteins and DNA and RNA, it's a fiction. They can't even figure out how you could get ribose by any quantity whatsoever. A simple thing like that. And it's certainly never generated nucleotides by radiating anything with ultraviolet light or whatever.
All right. And the last point has to do with the fossil record, that if species evolved into other species, what you're saying is there should be some forms of fossils of intermediary species, and that you're saying that there are none.
Yes, as a matter of fact, there should be just, our museum should be full of them, because everything on this Earth, every form of life has evolved, and we've gone from a little so-called simple microscopic organism into people and everything else in between during hundreds of millions of years, if evolution is true. Well, of course, this would have produced an enormous number of transitional forms, and evolution should be the most well-documented theory in science. What we have, actually, is a systematic absence of the transition forms between the major kinds. Now, evolutionists point to some suggestions, they say, for possible transitional forms in the mammal-like reptiles, or a case of Archaeopteryx, the bird, and so forth and so on. These are all questionable and disputable, as each basic type does appear fully formed. And of course, as I have pointed out already, two major aspects of the fossil record, the origin of the complex invertebrates, clams and snails and things like that, and the origin of fishes, supposedly the first vertebrate, this be the most astounding event in all of evolution, the origin of the vertebrates, we have not even a trace of ancestors or intermediates for those things. As I mentioned, if an invertebrate, some kind of invertebrate, a fish or a jellyfish or a clam or snail, something like that, evolved into a fish, they estimate 100 million years or something, enormous stretch of time, we ought to have just billions and billions of the transitional forms showing this transition from an invertebrate into a fish. As a matter of fact, we don't even have one. I mean, not one single major kind of fish can they find an ancestor for it, or transitional form showing these fishes linked to a common ancestor. Nothing like that. As far as I'm concerned, that settles the question. I mean, that fact, the total absence of any ancestors for the major invertebrates, total absence of ancestors for the major kind of fishes, settles the issue. Evolution has not taken place on this planet. And therefore, you see, the only alternative is creation. There's only two possibilities. Either we evolved naturally, or we were created supernaturally. And of course, we also point out that the evidence for design and purpose that we see all about us, the complexity, design, and purpose, also, that points to a designer, points to someone that had to be responsible for the origin of this vast complexity.
All right. Let's pause briefly for the benefit of anyone who may be tuning in late. I'm Hugh LaFollette. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest this evening is Duane Gish, Senior Vice President for the Institute for Creation Research, and he is explaining why he thinks creationism is true. What you've just said, you outlined your three arguments against evolution and in favor of creationism. And in giving the evidence, you talked about evolution being a fiction, that it was just clear that it was wrong. It then does seem there's an interesting psychological fact that has to be explained, which is why and how do all and I think you would agree, intelligent, well-educated people who believe in evolution, why are they systematically mistaken?
Well, I think there's several reasons for that. When Darwin came out with his theory of natural selection, variation of natural selection, it seems such a reasonable explanation. I think even then the majority of scientists were looking for something, for some way to justify evolution. I think they really preferred it, but they just didn't have any way to justify it. When Darwin came out with this idea, they flocked to it. It seemed to provide the answer that they were looking for. Philosophically, I think they were prepared for it and they wanted it. Because if you believe in creation, then you face this problem of a creator. And if God created us, then he must have created us for a purpose. There must be some reason for it, and there must be some relationship between the created and the creator. And he controlled their destiny. I think they didn't like that idea. I think they were looking for some way out. Now, I certainly don't want to imply that all evolutionists are atheists, because they certainly are not. But I think the leading ones are. But I think philosophically, this is where they stand. And this has been stated by Theodore Dobzhansky many years ago, said that the philosophy of the biological establishment was this materialist mechanist philosophy, which Jacques Monod had stated very eloquently. And I think philosophically, there's a great reason for this. And furthermore, as we come up through our public school system today in universities and colleges, we are literally bombarded with evolution. We are told that evolution is a fact. We are told that it's the central unifying principle of biology. We're told things like that. And so it's reasonable, if people feel, to accept evolution because most people believe it, we are told. And so it's tremendous pressure. I warn graduate students, I say, if you want to go to a major university and get a PhD in a natural science, don't tell them you're a creationist. And do your job, do your research, do what you're expected to do. But if you tell them you're a creationist, you're going to be bounced right out of there. You're not going to get a PhD. If you're a professor, young professor, without tenure, in a major university, in a natural science, they find out you're a creationist, you'll never get tenure. That's not true of every university, of course, but it's true of most universities. So that's tremendous pressure. I truly believe, if there are no pressure, no discrimination of any kind against creationists, I think there'd be an enormous number of people who would identify themselves as creationists, not a majority, but certainly many, many, many more. And I think, in other words, it's peer pressure, tremendous peer pressure. Dr. Dean Kenyon at San Francisco State University was an evolutionist. I purchased his book many years ago, Biochemical Predestination, a book in which he was exploring the idea of evolutionary origin of life. Later he became a creationist, convinced creationist, and he began to present an alternative in his class in biology there at San Francisco State. I believe it was the dean and his department head took the course away from him, wouldn't let him teach it. He appealed to the university, to the professors, and they said they didn't agree with him, majority didn't agree with him, but they believed he had the right to teach the course, and it was restored to him. But he had tenure, they couldn't fire him. So we see that sort of thing today, unfortunately. It's just too bad. You see, the justification is supposedly, well, evolution is science. Creation is religion. You can't teach religion in our public schools. You shouldn't bring it into universities. We are bound to teach according to science. Now, I agree with that. Certainly in biochemistry, what I saw happening today, I assumed happened yesterday and what happened in the future. When we're dealing with the operation of the universe, the operation of living things, we are restricted to natural laws and natural processes. But the origin of the universe, the origin of life, the origin of man, the origin of living things is something very, very different. There were no human witnesses there. They were events that happened in an unobservable past. They're not repeatable in the present. And we have to consider these two possibilities, a naturalistic evolutionary origin and a supernatural direct spatial creation. Let's look at the evidence. Let's look at the fossil record. Let's look at the laws of thermodynamics, laws of probability. Let's apply all of that evidence and then try to decide which seemed to be the most reasonable explanation. I think when that is done, creation wins, hands down, but they want to exclude that, you see, under this excuse that creation is religion and evolution is science. I say this, neither creation nor evolution is a scientific theory. There are no human witnesses there. You can't repeat it in the present. Therefore, they are inferences based upon circumstantial evidence. One is just as valid as the other. One is just as scientific as the other. One is just as religious as the other. So I think our students should have the opportunity to look at both sides. And I appreciate what you're doing today because you're making this available to your listeners.
Okay. Let me go back. One thing you said a moment ago is that I'd like you to elaborate on, is you said that not all evolutionists are atheists. So could you say a little bit more about that?
Yes.
What might lead a Christian to continue to be an evolutionist on your
view? Yes, I've met many theistic evolutionists, Christians, others, Muslims, Jews, believers. They're not atheists by any means, but they're evolutionists, and they believe that God must have used evolution in his creation. Well, I have only one comment about a theistic evolutionist. I think he's dead wrong twice. I think he's dead wrong on his theology, and I think he's dead wrong on his science. Evolution, after all, is the most wasteful, inefficient process that one could conceive to create, based as it is on these mutations, and any scientist would agree, at least, that almost all mutations are bad. I've never been convinced that any are good, but let us assume that just almost all are bad, and just once in a while, very rarely, one happens to be good. Then you have a good mutant supposedly gaining some advantage over the normal population, and then there's a struggle for existence, and the good mutant must kill off all the original in the struggle for existence in order to survive. So evolution is based upon these horrible mutations which produce blindness and sterility and crippling conditions of all kinds, genetic diseases by the thousands and things like that. And then you have to have the struggle for existence, the killing off of billions times billions of organisms in the struggle for existence. It's a horrible, terrible process. I certainly do not believe God would use such a terrible process. I always say if you want to believe in evolution, that's your business, but I wouldn't blame it on God. Now, furthermore, if theistic evolution is true, if God did use evolution, then we'd have to have at least two things. We'd have to see a natural tendency of simple things to organize themselves into more complex systems. We'd have to find these transitional forms that evolution requires. We find neither. There's no natural tendency for any system to naturally transform itself to a higher state of organization and complexity. Everything wears out. The entire universe is wearing out. It's running down. We're going in precisely the opposite direction if this natural evolutionary process is at work. And secondly, we don't find the transitional forms that a theistic evolutionist should expect, should find, if evolution is true. So I think based upon both the science, the attributes of God, and everything we know, I think the theistic evolutionist, I just think he's just wrong twice.
Okay. Let me ask, there are a couple things that you said indicates that you think that evolution is bad, not only because you take it to be bad science and, as you just said, bad theology, but because it has other implications,
yes,
that you would find objectionable. Could you say a little bit about
that? You see, our young people are being taught the universe started with a big bang. And that big bang created two things. It created hydrogen gas and helium gas. And that's all. That's all there was. This universe started out that way. And so he says, well, look, everything started out with hydrogen gas. Everything has been produced naturally by evolution. Who needs God? I see no need for God. I see no place for God. There is no God. Now, if there is no God, there's no one to whom I am responsible. I am only responsible to myself. I think we have seen the inevitable result of that teaching in our society today. Now, I'd be foolish to sit here and blame all of the ills of our society on evolution. But I believe one of the major reasons we've seen these changes in our society is because our judges, our educators, our legislators, and our leaders in our society have been indoctrinated in evolution theory. They've accepted this mechanist, materialist philosophy, and their decisions are guided by that. And we have this tremendous drug culture, the AIDS plague, we have legalized pornography and legalized abortion and all of this, which was a tremendous revolutionary changes in our society, which we feel is going in the wrong direction. And so we feel that we want these young people to know that there is evidence for the existence of a creator, the existence of God. We have the actual physical evidence for his existence. And therefore, it certainly should lead to some difference in their lives.
Okay. So that one of the main implications is that you think it's evolution is perhaps not wholly, but largely responsible for any loss of, for the absence of any view of morality.
I think so, because, you see, before we had absolute standards. You know, as a scientist, we're looking for absolute standards. We must have absolute standards before we can work in the laboratory. Well, we need that in our moral and our ethical lives as well. And God provides these absolute standards. When we do away with them, we have no standards. We're left with no standards at all. It's everyone decides for himself what he wants to do. You see, we have this hedonistic society that we have today is unquestionable, and we just feel we're going in the wrong direction. We want to give the students a chance to hear the other side.
Okay, we're just about out of time. You have a 30-second summary of your position.
Yes. I believe the scientific evidence, a major form of the scientific evidence from thermodynamics, the laws of probability, and the fossil record provide powerful, positive support for creation. And I believe it's a very, very important issue today, this issue of origins, creation versus evolution.
Okay. Thank you very much for being with us this evening.
My pleasure, Dr. LaFollette.
I've been talking this evening with Duane Gish, Senior Vice President for the Institute for Creation Research. This is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good evening.